human bodies against the ultra-high acceleration of space travel. Hence the term deep sea state. Dongfang Yanxu nodded. But you should know that there's a way to get around that. If you set the spacecraft to remote control, then it will assume that no one is on board and won't perform the check. This setting is part of the captain's permissions.
Let me try it, and you tell me if I've got it right.
Zhang Beihai activated an interface in front of him and began setting up remote control mode for the spacecraft, looking at a small notebook from time to time as he did so. Dongfang Yanxu smiled at the notebook. There are more efficient recording methods now.
Oh, it's just habit. For particularly important things, it's always more reassuring to write them down like this. It's just that I can't find a pen now. I brought two with me into hibernation, but only the pencil was still usable.
You've learned quickly.
That's because the command system retains a lot of the Navy's style. After all these years, the names of things haven't even changed. The engine orders, for example.
The space fleet did have its origins in the Navy. Okay, you'll soon be receiving system permissions as the acting captain of Natural Selection. This warship is in Class A standby, or as they called it in your time, fired up and ready to go.
She extended her slender arms and turned a circle in the air.
Zhang Beihai had not been able to figure out how to perform that action using the superconducting belt.
We didn't fire up in those days, but you evidently know quite a bit of naval history, he said, changing the subject from the sensitive issue that was liable to make her hostile to him.
A grand old branch of the service.
Doesn't the space fleet inherit that grandeur?
Yes, but I'm going to leave it. I plan on resigning.
Because of the review?
She turned to look at him, her thin black hair leaping again from the lack of gravity. You encountered this sort of thing all the time back then, didn't you?
Not necessarily. But if we did, every comrade would understand, because undergoing review is one of the duties of a soldier.
2 centuries have passed. This is no longer your time.
Dongfang, don't deliberately widen the gap. There are similarities between the two of us. Soldiers in all ages have to bear up under humiliation.
Are you advising me to stay?
No.
Ideological work. That's the word, isn't it? Wasn't that your duty once?
Not anymore. I have a new duty.
She floated easily around him, as if carefully studying him. Is it that we're children to you? 1/2 a year ago I went to Earth, and in one hibernator district, a 6 or 7-year-old boy called me a kid.
He laughed.
Are we kids to you?
In our day, seniority was very important. In the countryside, there were adults who called children aunt and uncle because of family seniority.
But your seniority is unimportant to me.
I can see that in your eyes.
Your daughter and your wife, they didn't come with you. Special contingent family members were allowed to hibernate too, as far as I'm aware.
They didn't come, and they didn't want me to go. You know, trends at the time pointed toward a very bleak future. They criticized me for being irresponsible. She and her mother moved out, and in the dead of night the day after they left. The special contingent received the order. I didn't even have time to see them again. It was on a late winter's night, a cold one, that I left home carrying my bags. Of course, I'm not expecting you to understand any of this.
I understand. What happened to them?
My wife died in year 47, my daughter in year 81.
They saw the Great Ravine.
She lowered her eyes and remained silent for a while.
Then she activated a holographic window and switched to an external display mode. The bulkheads of the white sphere melted like wax, and Natural Selection vanished, leaving them suspended in infinite space,
facing the misty starfield of the Milky Way. They were now two independent beings in the universe, unattached to any world, with nothing but the abyss surrounding them. They hung in the universe like the Earth, the Sun, and the galaxy itself, with no origin and no destination, simply existing. Zhang Beihai had experienced this feeling before, 190 years ago, when he floated in space wearing nothing but a spacesuit, holding a pistol loaded with meteorite bullets.
"I like it this way, where you can ignore the spacecraft and the fleet and everything outside your own mind," she said.
"Dongfeng," he called softly.
"Hmm?"
The captain turned around, her eyes shining with the starlight of the Milky Way.
"If the day comes when I have to kill you, please forgive me," he said gently.
She met his words with a smile.
"Do I look to you like I'm imprinted?"
He looked at her in the sunlight coming from 5 AU away. She was a lithe feather floating against the backdrop of the starfield.
"We belong to the earth and sea. You belong to the stars."
"Is that bad?"
"No. It's very good."
"The probe's gone out!"
The report from the duty officer came as a shock to Dr. Kuhn and General Robinson. They knew that once the news got out, it would make waves in both the Earth International and the Fleet International, particularly since the latest observations of the probe's speed meant that it would cross the orbit of Jupiter in just 6 days. Kuhn and Robinson were on the Ringye Fitzroy station that orbited the Sun along the outside rim of the asteroid belt. Floating in space 5 kilometers away from the station were the most peculiar objects in the solar system. A set of 6 giant lenses, the top one 1,200 meters in diameter, and the 5 below it slightly smaller in size. This was the latest incarnation of the space telescope, but unlike the previous 5 generations of the Hubble, this space telescope had no barrel or any connecting material at all between the 6 giant lenses. They floated independently, the rim of each lens equipped with multiple ion thrusters that could precisely adjust the distance between them or change the orientation of the entire group. Ringye Fitzroy Station was the control center for the telescope, but even from this close, the transparent lenses were practically invisible. When technicians and engineers would fly between them during maintenance, the universe on either side would be grossly distorted, and if they were at the proper angle, the protective iris on the surface would reflect the sunlight and reveal the entire giant lens, whose curved surface would then resemble a planet covered in bewitching rainbows. The telescope broke with the Hubble series naming convention and was dubbed the Ringye Fitzroy Telescope to commemorate the two men who discovered the tracks of the Trisolaran fleet. Although their discovery had no scholarly significance, the name was fitting, because the primary purpose of this massive telescope, a joint project of the 3 major fleets, was the continued monitoring of the Trisolaran fleet. A team like Ringye and Fitzroy, a lead scientist from Earth and a head of military affairs from the fleet, had always been in charge of the telescope, and in every such team there were the same differences of opinion that Ringye and Fitzroy had. Right now, Kuhn wanted to squeeze in some observation time for his own study of the cosmos, while Robinson worked to stop him, so as to safeguard the fleet's interests. They argued about other things, too. For example, Kuhn reminisced over the wonderful way that Earth's superpowers, headed up by the United States, were leading the world, in contrast to the fleet's current inefficient bureaucracy. But every time he did so, Robinson would ruthlessly dismantle Kuhn's ridiculous historical fantasies. But the most heated argument was over the station's rotation speed. The general insisted on a slow rotation for minimal gravity, even to the point of keeping the station in an entirely weightless state with no rotation at all, while Kuhn stumped for a fast rotation and Earth-standard gravity. But what was happening now overwhelmed all of that. The probe having gone out meant that its engines had turned off. 2 years before, far beyond the Oort cloud, the probe had begun to decelerate, which meant that its engine had started up in a sun-facing direction, enabling the space telescope to track the probe by engine light. Now that the light had gone out, tracking was no longer possible, because the probe itself was far too small, probably no bigger than a truck, based on the wake it left crossing the interstellar dust. An object that small out on the periphery of the Kuiper Belt, no longer emitting its own light and reflecting the weak light of the distant sun even more weakly, even a telescope as powerful as Ringier Fitzroy couldn't see such a tiny dark object so far off in the darkness of space.
"The three fleets don't know how to do anything but struggle over power. This is just perfect. The target's been lost," Kuhn grumbled, waving his arms for emphasis.
He forgot the station was now in a weightless state, and his movements caused him to perform a somersault. For the first time, General Robinson did not defend the fleet. The Asian fleet had originally dispatched three light, high-speed ships to track the probe at close range. But after the dispute erupted among the three fleets over the right to intercept, the joint conference had issued a resolution recalling all craft to base. The Asian fleet repeatedly protested that the three fighter-class spaceships had been stripped of all weapons and external equipment and were carrying a crew of just two people each to achieve maximum acceleration for tracking the target. And even so, they could not possibly intercept the probe. However, the European and North American fleets were unconvinced and insisted that all spaceships in transit be recalled and replaced by three spaceships dispatched by Earth International as a fourth party. If not for that, the fleet ships would already have made close contact with the probe and begun tracking it. Earth ships, dispatched by the European Commonwealth and China, had not even passed the orbit of Neptune.
"Perhaps. Its engines might start up again," the general said. "It's still traveling pretty fast, and if it doesn't decelerate, it won't be able to rest in solar orbit. It'll pass right through the solar system."
"Are you the Trisolaran commander? Maybe the probe wasn't ever planning on remaining in the solar system, but was just going to pass through anyway," Kuhn said.
Then a thought suddenly struck him.
"If the engines are off, then it can't change course. Can't you just figure out where it's headed and send the tracking spacecraft to wait for it?"
The general shook his head.
"That's not precise enough. It's not like an Air Force search in Earth's atmosphere. One minuscule error and you'll be hundreds of thousands or even millions of kilometers off course. In such a huge area, the tracking craft won't be able to find such a tiny dark target. But we've got to come up with a way somehow."
"What can we do? Let the fleet figure it out."
The general turned tough.
"Doctor, you've got to realize the nature of the situation. Even though this isn't our fault, the media won't care. The Ringier Fitzroy system was, after all, responsible for tracking the probe in deep space, so a good portion of that dirty water is going to land on our heads."
Kuhn said nothing, but remained with his body perpendicular to the general's for a while. Then he asked,
"Is there anything else outside Neptune's orbit that could be useful?"
"For the fleet, probably nothing. For Earth..."
The general turned to ask the duty officer, and soon learned that the UN Environmental Protection Organization had four large ships near Neptune, working on the early stages of the Fog Umbrella Project. The three small craft newly tasked with tracking the probe had been dispatched from those ships.
"Are they going there to mine oil film?"
Kuhn asked. The reply was affirmative. Oil film was a substance found in Neptune's rings. At high temperatures, it turned into a rapidly diffusing gas that then condensed into nanoparticles in space, forming space dust. It was so called because when it evaporated, it became highly diffusive, so a small quantity of the substance could form a large patch of dust,
like a tiny droplet of oil spreading into an oil film of molecular thickness across a large area of water. Dust formed from this oil film had another property. Unlike other types of space dust, oil film dust was not easily dispersed by the solar wind. It was the discovery of oil film that made the Fog Umbrella Project possible. The plan was to use nuclear blasts in space to evaporate and spread the oil film substance into a cloud of oil film dust between the Sun and Earth as a means of decreasing the Sun's radiation on Earth and alleviating global warming.
"I remember there's supposed to be a stellar bomb near Neptune orbit from before the wars," Kuhn said.
"There is, and the Fog Umbrella spaceships brought along a few, too, for blasting Neptune and its satellites. I'm not sure of the precise number."
"I'd say one is enough," Kuhn said excitedly.
Like wall-facer Ray Diaz had predicted 2 centuries prior, when he developed the stellar hydrogen bomb for his wall-facer plan, although the weapon would be of limited use in the Doomsday Battle, the major powers wanted it to prepare for the possible outbreak of interplanetary war between humans. More than 5,000 bombs had been manufactured, mostly during the Great Ravine, when international relations grew volatile due to lack of resources, and humanity was pushed to the brink of war. When the new era dawned, the horrifying weapons became dangerous non-essentials that were kept in storage in outer space, although they still belonged to countries on Earth. A few of them were blown up in planetary engineering projects, and another set was sent into orbit in the remote solar system with the notion that the fusion materials could supplement the fuel of long-range spacecraft. However, because of the difficulty involved in dismantling the bombs, this idea was never realized.
"Do you think it'll work?"
Robinson asked, his eyes aglow. He was a little rueful that he hadn't thought up such a simple idea himself, and that Kuhn had snatched the opportunity to go down in history.
"Give it a try. It's the only thing we've got."
"If your idea works, Doctor, then the Ringier-Fitzroy station will forever revolve fast enough to generate Earth gravity."
"It's the biggest thing humanity has ever made,"
the commander of Blue Shadow said, as he looked out the spacecraft's window into the pitch black of space. Nothing was visible, but he tried to convince himself that he could see the dust cloud.
"Why isn't it lit by the sun, like the tail of a comet?" the pilot said.
He and the commander were the only crew on Blue Shadow. He knew the density of the dust cloud was as thin as a comet's tail, or about the same as a vacuum created in an Earth-based laboratory.
"Maybe the sunlight is too weak."
The commander looked back at the sun, which, in the lonely space between Neptune's orbit and the Kuiper Belt, looked like a large star, its disk shape only barely distinguishable. Still, even the weak sunlight could still cast shadows on the bulkhead.
"Besides, a comet tail is only visible from a certain distance away. We're just at the edge of the cloud."
The pilot tried to conjure up a mental image of the thin yet gigantic cloud. A few days ago, he and the commander had seen with their own eyes how small the cloud was when compressed into a solid. At the time, the giant spaceship Pacific had arrived from Neptune and left behind 5 things when it stopped in this section of space. The Blue Shadow's mechanical arm first retrieved a stellar hydrogen bomb from the early days of the war, a cylinder 5 meters long and 1.5 meters in diameter. Next, it picked up 4 large spheres between 30 and 50 meters in diameter. The 4 spheres, the oil film harvested from Neptune's rings, were placed at points several 100 meters from the bomb. Once Pacific had departed the vicinity, the bomb exploded, forming a small sun whose light and heat surged into the cold abyss of space and instantly vaporized the surrounding spheres. The gaseous oil film diffused rapidly under the typhoon of H-bomb radiation, then cooled into countless tiny particles of dust, forming a cloud. The cloud had a diameter of 2 million kilometers, greater than that of the sun. The dust cloud was located in the region that the Trisolaran probe was expected to pass through, according to path observations made prior to its engine shutting off. Dr. Kuhn and General Robinson hoped to precisely determine the probe's path and position by the tracks it left in the man-made dust cloud. Following the formation of the cloud, Pacific returned to Neptune Base, leaving behind three small spaceships that would track the probe closely once its wake showed. Blue Shadow was one of them. The small high-speed ship had been dubbed a Space Racer. With a small capsule that could seat five as its only payload, its remaining volume was entirely occupied by a fusion engine, giving it high acceleration and maneuverability. Once the dust cloud took shape, Blue Shadow flew through the entire area to test whether wakes would be left, with quite satisfactory results. Of course, the wakes could only be observed by the space telescope more than 100 AU distant. From Blue Shadow itself, its own wake was invisible, and the surrounding space was as deserted as it always had been. Still, after passing through the cloud, the pilot insisted that the sun looked a little dimmer, that its formerly sharp circumference had gone a bit blurry. Instrument observations confirmed the sole visual impression they had of this giant creation.
"Less than 3 hours to go," the commander said, looking at his watch.
The dust cloud was actually a giant, thin satellite in orbit around the sun, its position constantly changing. When it eventually moved out of the space where the probe might pass through, another dust cloud would have to be created behind it.
"Do you really hope we'll catch up to it?" the pilot asked.
"Why not? We're making history."
"Won't the thing attack us? We're not soldiers. This really ought to be done by the fleet."
Then their spacecraft received a message from the Ringier Fitzroy station, reporting that the Trisolaran probe had entered the dust cloud and left a wake, and that precise parameters had been calculated for its trajectory. Blue Shadow was ordered to move immediately to rendezvous with and closely track the target. The station was more than 100 AU away from Blue Shadow, meaning the message was delayed more than 10 hours in transit, but the key had made an impression in the mold. Orbital calculations had even taken into account the effect of the thin dust cloud, so a rendezvous was just a matter of time. Blue Shadow set a course in accordance with the probe's path, and once again entered the invisible dust cloud, this time heading in the direction of the Trisolaran probe. It was a long flight this time, and over the course of more than 10 hours, both pilot and commander grew sleepy. But the continuously shrinking distance between them and the probe kept them on edge.
"I see it! I see it!" the pilot shouted.
"What are you talking about? There's still over 14,000 kilometers to go," rebuked the commander.
The naked eye could not possibly see a truck at a distance of 14,000 kilometers, even given the transparency of space. But soon, he saw it for himself. On the trajectory described by the parameters, against the silent backdrop of space, a point of light was in motion. After a moment's thought, the commander understood. The cloud of dust larger than the sun had been unnecessary, since the Trisolaran probe had restarted its engines and was continuing to decelerate. It did not intend to skip through the solar system. It would remain here. Because it was only a temporary measure in the fleets, the ceremony for handing over captain's permissions on natural selection was a simple and low-key affair, attended only by Captain Dongfang Yanxu, Acting Captain Zhang Beihai, First Vice Captain Levine, and Second Vice Captain Akira Inoue, as well as a special team from the General Staff Department. Despite this era's technological development, they had still not managed to overcome the stagnation of fundamental theory, so natural selection's permissions transfer was done via means Zhang Beihai was familiar with: three-way pupil, fingerprint, and passphrase authentication. Once the General Staff team had finished resetting the pupil and fingerprint data that identified the captain in the system, Dongfang Yanxu
surrendered her passphrase to Zhang Beihai. Men always remember love because of romance only.
You don't smoke, he replied calmly.
And the brand was lost during the Great Ravine, she said with a trace of disappointment and lowered her eyes.
But the password's a good one. Not many people knew it back then, either.
The captain and vice-captains exited, leaving Zhang Beihai alone to update the password and obtain complete control over natural selection.
He's clever,
Akira Inoue said when the door to the spherical cabin vanished.
Ancient wisdom,
Dongfang Yanxu said, watching the spot where the door had disappeared, as if trying to see through it.
We'll never be able to learn the stuff he brought from 2 centuries ago, but he can learn what we know.
Then the three of them remained silent and waited. 5 minutes passed, clearly too long for changing a password, especially since Captain-in-Waiting Zhang Beihai had come through training as the most skilled command system operator out of all the members of his special contingent. 5 more minutes passed. The two vice-captains began swimming impatiently in the corridor, but Dongfang Yanxu remained silent and motionless. At last, the door reappeared. To their surprise, the spherical cabin had turned black. Zhang Beihai had a holographic star map pulled up on which the labels had been blocked, leaving only the twinkling stars. From the doorway, he seemed to be suspended outside the spaceship, with his interface floating alongside him.
I'm done, he said.
Why did it take so long?
Levine grumbled.
Were you relishing the thrill of gaining natural selection?
Akira Inoue asked. Zhang Beihai said nothing. He didn't look at the interface, but gazed off instead at a star in a distant part of the map. Dongfang Yanxu noticed that a green light was flashing in the direction he was looking.
That would be ridiculous,
Levine said, picking up from Akira Inoue.
May I remind you that the captainship still belongs to Colonel Dongfang? The acting captain is just a firewall. I'm sorry to be rude about it, but that's pretty much the truth.
Akira Inoue said,
And this state won't last for very long. The investigation of the fleet is nearing an end, and it's basically been proven that the imprinted don't exist.
He was about to go on, but was stopped by a low gasp of surprise from the captain.
Oh, God,
she said. And the two vice-captains, following her eyes, noticed natural selection's current status on Zhang Beihai's interface. The warship had been set into remote control mode, thereby bypassing the check for deep sea state prior to Ahead 4. Outside communication had been severed, and finally, most of the captain's settings for putting the ship into maximum propulsion were in place. With the push of just one more button, natural selection would head off at maximum speed to the target selected on the map.
No, this can't be happening,
Dongfang Yanxu said, her voice so low only she could hear it. It was for her own ears, in response to her earlier God exclamation. She had never believed in the existence of God, but now her prayers were real.
Are you insane?
Levine shouted. He and Akira Inoue rushed toward the cabin, only to crash into the bulkhead. There was no door, just an oval-shaped section of wall that had turned transparent.
Natural selection is about to proceed to Ahead 4. All crew must enter deep sea state immediately,
Zhang Beihai said, every word in his solemn, calm voice lingering in the air like an ancient anchor standing in the chill wind.
This is impossible,
Akira Inoue said.
Are you imprinted?
Dongfang Yanxu asked, quickly calming herself.
You know that's not possible.
ETO?
No.
Then who are you?
A soldier carrying out his duty to fight for humanity's survival.
Why are you doing this?
I'll explain after acceleration is complete. I repeat,
all crew must enter deep sea state immediately.
This is impossible,
Akira Inoue repeated. Zhangbei Hai turned around, and without so much as looking at the two vice captains, stared straight at Dongfang Yanxu. His eyes instantly reminded her of the emblem of the Chinese Space Force, bearing swords and stars alike.
Dongfang, I said that I would be sorry if I had to kill you. There is not much time.
Then the deep sea acceleration fluid appeared within Zhangbei Hai's spherical compartment, forming into balls in the weightless environment. Each liquid globe, containing his distorted reflection along with the interface and the star map, began to combine into larger ones. The two vice captains looked at Dongfang Yanxu.
Do as he says. The whole ship will enter deep sea state, the captain said.
The two vice captains stared at her. They knew what the consequences were for proceeding to a head four outside of the deep sea protective state. The body would be plastered to the bulkhead by a force 120 times that of Earth gravity. First, blood would burst out under the immense weight, spreading into a thin layer of impossibly huge, radially patterned bloodstains, and then the organs would be squeezed out, forming another thin layer that would be pressed together with the body into an ugly Dali painting. As they left for their cabins, they issued orders to the entire ship to enter a deep sea state.
You're a well-qualified captain.
Zhangbei Hai nodded at Dongfang Yanxu.
This shows maturity.
Where are we going?
Wherever we're going, it's a more responsible choice than staying here.
And then he was submerged in the deep sea acceleration fluid, and Dongfang Yanxu could only make out a murky body through the liquid now filling the spherical compartment. Floating in the translucent liquid, Zhangbei Hai recalled his diving experience in the Navy 2 centuries before. He had never imagined that the ocean would be so dark a few dozen meters down, but that undersea world gave him the same feeling he later found in space. The ocean was space in miniature on Earth. He tried breathing, but his reflexes made him violently cough up liquid and residual gas, and his body shifted with the recoil. Still, there wasn't the suffocation that he had anticipated, and as cool liquid filled his lungs, the oxygen it contained was supplied to his blood. He could breathe freely, like a fish. On the interface suspended in the liquid, he saw that the deep sea acceleration fluid was filling each occupied compartment in the spaceship in turn. The process continued for more than 10 minutes. His consciousness began to blur, as the breathing liquid was injected with a hypnotic component that put everyone aboard ship into a state of sleep, so as to avoid damage to the brain from the high pressure and relative hypoxia generated by acceleration at a head four. Zhangbei Hai felt his father's spirit alight on the spaceship from the beyond, becoming one with it. He pressed the button on the interface, issuing in his mind the command that he had been working toward his entire life.
Natural selection. Ahead four.
A small sun appeared in Jovian orbit, its bright light washing out the phosphorescence of the planet's atmosphere. Dragging the sun behind it, the stellar-class warship Natural Selection eased out of the Asian fleet base and accelerated rapidly, casting shadows of the other warships, each dark spot big enough to contain the Earth, onto the Jovian surface. 10 minutes later, a larger shadow was flung onto Jupiter like a curtain drawn across the giant planet. Natural Selection was passing Io. It was at this point that the Asian Fleet High Command confirmed the incredible fact that Natural Selection had defected. The European and North American fleets issued protests and warnings to the Asian fleet under the initial impression that it was an unauthorized move to intercept the Trisolaran probe, but they soon realized from Natural Selection's heading that this was not the case. It was headed in the opposite direction
from the Trisolaran invasion. The various systems hailing natural selection gradually let up after receiving no response. The high commands began to deploy pursuit and intercept ships, although they soon realized that little could be done about the defector warship. Bases on four of Jupiter's moons possessed sufficient firepower to destroy natural selection, but they would not take that path, because it was quite likely that only a small minority of those on board, or even a single individual, had actually defected, and the 2,000-odd soldiers in deep sea state were merely hostages. Commanders at the Gamma Ray laser base on Europa could only watch as the small sun flew across the sky and into outer space, sprinkling Europa's vast ice sheets with light like burning phosphorus. Natural selection crossed the orbits of 16 Jovian moons and achieved escape velocity by the time it reached Callisto. Seen from the Asian fleet base, the small sun gradually shrank, turning into a bright star which remained faintly visible for a week, as a reminder from the stars of the lasting pain of the Asian fleet. Since the pursuing force had to enter deep sea state, it took 45 minutes after natural selection left for those ships to launch, lighting up Jupiter with another six suns. At Asian Fleet Command, which had stopped rotating, the commander silently faced the giant dark side of Jupiter as lightning flashed in the atmosphere 10,000 kilometers below him. Powerful radiation from the fusion engines of natural selection and the pursuing force had caused atmospheric ionization and lightning. The fleeting lightning strikes illuminated the surrounding atmosphere, visible at this distance as halos in constantly changing locations, turning the surface of Jupiter into a pond spattered with fluorescent rain. Natural selection accelerated in silence to 1/100th the speed of light, the point of no return for its fusion fuel consumption. Now unable to return to the solar system under its own power, it had become a lonely boat bound to forever wander in outer space. The commander of the Asian fleet gazed at the stars, trying unsuccessfully to find one in particular, for all there was in that direction was the faint light of the pursuer's fusion engines. A report soon came in. Natural selection had stopped accelerating. A while later, natural selection restored communication with the fleet. Then the following communication took place, with delays of more than 10 seconds between transmissions, due to the fact that the ship was now over 5 million kilometers away. Natural selection.
Natural selection calling Asian fleet. Natural selection calling Asian fleet.
Asian fleet.
Natural selection, Asian fleet reads you. Report your status.
Natural selection.
This is Acting Captain Zhang Beihai. I'll speak directly to the fleet commander.
Fleet commander.
I'm listening.
Zhang Beihai.
I take full responsibility for natural selection's breakaway voyage.
Fleet commander.
Is anyone else responsible?
Zhang Beihai.
No. Responsibility is mine alone. The situation has nothing at all to do with anyone else aboard natural selection.
Fleet commander.
I want to talk to Captain Dongfang Yanxu.
Zhang Beihai.
Not now.
Fleet commander.
What is the ship's current status?
Zhang Beihai.
All is good. Every crew member is still in deep sea state, apart from me. Power systems and life support are operating normally.
Fleet commander.
And your reasons for this treason?
Zhang Beihai.
I may have deserted, but I am no traitor.
Fleet commander.
Your reasons?
Zhang Beihai.
Humanity is certain to lose on the battlefield. I only want to save one of Earth's stellar-class spaceships to preserve a seed of human civilization in the universe. A scrap of hope.
Fleet commander.
That makes you an escapist.
Zhang Beihai.
I'm just a soldier fulfilling his duty.
Fleet commander.
Have you received the mental seal?
Zhangbei Hai. You know that's not possible. That technology wasn't around when I went into hibernation.
Fleet Commander. Then your unusually resolute defeatist beliefs are baffling.
Zhangbei Hai. I don't need the mental seal. I am the master of my beliefs. My faith is resolute because it doesn't come from my own intelligence. At the beginning of the Trisolar Crisis, my father and I began to seriously consider the most basic questions about this war. Gradually, a group of deep-thinking scholars, including scientists, politicians, and military strategists, gathered around him. They called themselves the Future Historians.
Fleet Commander. Was it a secret organization?
Zhangbei Hai. No. They studied very basic questions, and their discussions were always conducted in the open. The government and military even came forward and held several academic conferences on future history. And it was from their research that I arrived at the mindset that humanity is doomed.
Fleet Commander. But the theories of future history have since been proven incorrect.
Zhangbei Hai. Sir, you underestimate them. They not only predicted the Great Ravine, but the Second Enlightenment and Second Renaissance as well. What they predicted for today's era of prosperity is virtually indistinguishable from the real thing. And finally, they predicted that humanity would be totally defeated, wiped out in the Doomsday Battle.
Fleet Commander, have you forgotten that you're on a spaceship capable of traveling at 15% of the speed of light?
Zhangbei Hai. Genghis Khan's cavalry attacked with the speed of 20th century armored units. The mounted crossbow of the Song dynasty had a range of up to 1,500 meters, comparable to 20th century assault rifles. But it's impossible for ancient cavalry and crossbows to compete with modern forces. Fundamental theory determines everything. The future historians clearly saw this point. You, on the other hand, have been blinded by the dying radiance of low-level technology and are luxuriating in the nursery of modern civilization without any mental preparation whatsoever for the coming ultimate battle that will determine the fate of humanity.
Fleet Commander, you come from a great army, one that was victorious over an enemy with far more advanced equipment. It won victory in one of the largest land wars in the world, relying solely on seized weapons. Your behavior is a disgrace to that army.
Zhangbei Hai. My dear commander, I'm more qualified than you to speak of that army. 3 generations of my family served in it. During the Korean War, my grandfather attacked a Pershing tank armed with a grenade. The grenade hit the tank and slid off before exploding. The target was barely scratched, but my grandfather was hit by machine gun fire from the tank, had both legs broken under its treads, and spent the rest of his life an invalid. But compared to 2 of his comrades, who were crushed to a pulp, he was lucky. It's that army's history that so clearly taught us the significance of a technological gap during wartime. The glory you know is what you've read in the history books. But our trauma was cemented by the blood of our fathers and grandfathers. We know more than you do what war means.
Fleet Commander. When did you conceive of your treasonous plan?
Zhangbei Hai. I repeat, I may have deserted, but I am not a traitor. I conceived of the plan the last time I saw my father. I saw in his eyes what I needed to do, and it took me 2 centuries to realize my plan.
Fleet Commander. And to do this, you disguised yourself as a triumphalist. A very successful disguise.
Zhangbei Hai. General Chang Wei-su almost saw through me.
Fleet Commander. Yes, he was keenly aware that he had never worked out the foundation of your triumphalist faith, and his suspicions were only aggravated by your unusual enthusiasm for radiation propulsion systems capable of interstellar travel.
He had always been opposed to you joining the special contingent of future reinforcements, but he couldn't breach his superior's orders. He warned us in the letter he sent, but did so in your era's subtle way, and we overlooked it. Zhang Beihai.
In order to obtain a spacecraft capable of fleeing into space, I killed 3 people.
Fleet Commander. We did not know that. Maybe no one did. But one thing is certain. The research direction chosen at that time was crucial for the subsequent development of spaceflight technology.
Zhang Beihai. Thank you for saying so.
Fleet Commander. I will also say that your plan will fail.
Zhang Beihai. Perhaps. But it hasn't yet.
Fleet Commander. Natural Selection's fusion fuel is only at 1/5 capacity.
Zhang Beihai. But I had to act immediately. There would be no other opportunity.
Fleet Commander. What it means is that you're only able to accelerate to 1% of light speed now. You can't consume excess fuel, because the spaceship's life support systems still need power to maintain operations for a time span that could be as short as a few decades or as long as a few centuries. But at that speed, the pursuing force will catch up to you quite soon.
Zhang Beihai. I still control natural selection.
Fleet Commander.
True.
And of course you know our concern. That pursuit will drive you to continue accelerating, expending fuel until life support fails, and natural selection becomes a dead ship at near absolute zero. That's why the pursuit force won't draw near natural selection for the time being. We have confidence that the commander and soldiers aboard will solve their own warship's problems.
Zhang Beihai. I'm also convinced that all problems will be resolved. I will shoulder my responsibility, but I still firmly believe that natural selection is headed in the right direction.
When Luoji jerked awake, he recognized something else that had endured from the past. Firecrackers. It was dawn, and through the window the desert glowed white in the early light, illuminated by bursts of firecrackers and fireworks. Then came an urgent knock at the door. Without waiting for it to be answered, Shi Xiaoming opened it up and charged in, his face red with excitement as he urged Luoji to watch the news. Luoji watched television only rarely. Since arriving in New Life Village No. 5, he had returned to a life in the past. After the post-awakening impact of the new era, this was a precious feeling for him, and, for the time being, he didn't want to be disturbed by information about the present day. He spent most of his time immersed in memories of Zhuang Yan and Xia Xia. All of the paperwork had been filed for their reawakening, but government controls on hibernators meant that it would not happen for 2 months. The television news broadcast the following. 5 hours ago, the Ringye Fitzroy telescope observed the Trisolaran fleet cross yet again into an interstellar dust cloud. This was the 7th time since its launch 2 centuries ago that the fleet had revealed itself by passing through a dust cloud. The fleet had lost its rigorous formation, so that the brush shape it had formed on passing through the first cloud was now altered beyond all recognition. But just as in its second crossing, a bristle was observed extending out in front. What was different this time, however, was that the shape of the track indicated that the bristle was not a probe, but a warship of the fleet. Having completed the acceleration and cruising legs of their journey to the solar system, some of the ships in the Trisolaran fleet had been observed decelerating as early as 15 years ago. 10 years ago, the majority of them had begun to slow down. It was clear now that this particular ship had never reduced speed. In fact, judging from its path through the dust cloud, it was still accelerating. At its current rate of acceleration, it would arrive in the solar system 50 years before the rest of the fleet. A lone ship charging into solar system territory and in range of Earth's powerful fleet would be suicide, if it was an invasion. This left just one possible conclusion. It was coming to negotiate. Observations of the Trisolaran fleet over the course of 2 centuries had determined the maximum acceleration of every ship, and projections indicated that this advanced ship would be unable to decelerate sufficiently, so it would pass right through the solar system in 150 years. That meant just 2 possibilities. The first was that the Trisolarans wanted Earth to assist in deceleration. More likely was that, before the ship passed out of the solar system, it would drop a smaller craft that could decelerate more easily, a ship that would be carrying the Trisolaran negotiation delegation.
But if they desired to negotiate, wouldn't they notify humanity by Sofon?
Luoji asked.
That's easy to explain, Shi Xiaoming said excitedly. It's a different way of thinking. The Trisolarans have totally transparent minds, so they imagine that we already know what they're thinking.
Even though the explanation was unconvincing, Luoji shared Shi Xiaoming's feeling, like the sun outside was rising early. When the sun rose for real, the revelry reached a climax. This was just a small corner of the world, and the center of the activity was in the underground cities, where people left their trees and crowded into the streets and plazas, their clothing turned up to maximum brightness to form a glowing sea of light. Virtual fireworks blossomed in the vaults overhead, and at times a colorful burst covered the entire sky, its brilliant light a match for the sun. News continued to arrive. The government was cautious at first, and its spokespersons stated repeatedly that there was no conclusive evidence to demonstrate that Trisolaris had the intent to negotiate. But, at the same time, the UN and the SFJC convened an emergency summit to formulate strategies for negotiation procedures and terms. In New Life Village No. 5, a short interlude paused the revelry. A city legislator came to make a speech. He was a fanatical supporter of what was called Project Sunshine, and was taking this opportunity to win the support of the hibernator community. Project Sunshine was a UN proposal whose main thrust was that, in the event of a human victory in the Doomsday Battle, defeated Trisolarans ought to be provided with space in the solar system. There were various versions of the project. The weak survival plan set up Pluto, Charon, and the moons of Neptune as Trisolaran reservations that would grant admission only to those aboard the defeated Trisolaris ships. The living conditions on these reservations would be very poor, and they would rely on fusion energy and the support of human society to sustain themselves. The strong survival plan would use Mars for the Trisolaran sojourn, and would eventually admit all Trisolaran immigrants, in addition to members of the fleet. This plan would provide Trisolaran civilization with the solar system's best living conditions apart from Earth. The other versions were more or less situated between these two, but there were also a few more extreme ideas, such as accepting Trisolarans into Earth society. Project Sunshine had won broad support from Earth International and Fleet International, and preliminary studies and planning had already begun, with many non-governmental forces in both internationals pushing for it. Yet it had encountered fierce resistance from the community of hibernators, who had even coined a name for supporters of the project, Dongguo, after the soft-hearted scholar in the fable who saved a wolf's life. As soon as the legislator's speech began, he was met with strong pushback from the audience, which tossed tomatoes at him. Ducking, he said,
"I'd like to remind you that we're in a humanitarian age following the Second Renaissance. The life and civilization of every race are accorded the greatest respect. You are bathed in the light of this age, are you not? Hibernators in modern society enjoy citizenship in complete equality and suffer no discrimination. This principle is recognized in the Constitution and in the law, but more importantly, it exists in everyone's heart. I trust you can appreciate this. Trisolaris II is a great civilization.
human society must acknowledge its right to exist. Project Sunshine is not a charity. It is an acknowledgement and an expression of humanity's own value. If we... Hey, jerks! Focus on your work!
The legislator's final line was addressed to his team, who were busily gathering up the tomatoes that had fallen to the ground. They were quite expensive underground, after all. When the hibernators saw this, they began tossing cucumbers and potatoes onto the stage as well, and thus the minor confrontation was revolved in mutual merriment. At noon, every household feasted. On the grass, a sumptuous meal of unadulterated agricultural products was laid out for the city folk who had come to join in the fun, including Mr. Dongguo the legislator and his entourage. The festivities continued tipsily through the afternoon and until sunset, which was exceptionally beautiful that evening. The sandy plains outside the neighborhood looked creamily soft and delicate under the red-orange sun, and the rolling dunes looked like the bodies of sleeping women. By nighttime, one news item pushed their flagging spirits to new heights of excitement. The Fleet International had made the decision to combine the Stellar-class warships of the Asian Fleet, the European Fleet, and the North American Fleet into a single fleet of 2,015 ships to sally forth in unison and intercept the Trisolaran probe as it crossed the orbit of Neptune. The news propelled the revelry to a renewed climax, and fireworks filled the night sky. But it also elicited some disdain and mockery.
Mobilizing 2,000 warships for a tiny probe? It's like using 2,000 butcher knives to kill a chicken.
That's right. 2,000 cannons to hit a mosquito. It's not that tough.
Hey, everyone. We should be more understanding of the Fleet International. You know, it might be the only chance they'll get to fight Trisolaris.
Right. If this can be called fighting.
It's okay. Just think of it as a military parade for humanity. Let's see what this super fleet's got. It'll scare the Trisolarans to death. They'll be so frightened they won't be able to pee. If they even have pee.
Laughter. Close to midnight, more news came. The combined fleet had set off from Jupiter base. Viewers were informed that in the southern sky, the fleet could be seen with the naked eye. At this, the revelers quieted down for the first time and searched the sky for Jupiter. It wasn't easy, but under the guidance of the expert on the television, they soon located the planet in the southwest. At this point, the light of the combined fleet was moving in Earth's direction from a distance of 5 AU. 45 minutes later, the brightness of Jupiter suddenly increased, soon surpassing Sirius to become the brightest object in the night sky. Then a brilliant shining star separated from Jupiter, like a soul leaving a body. The planet returned to its original brightness as the star moved slowly away from it. That was the launch of the combined fleet. At practically the same time, live images of Jupiter base reached Earth. On the television, people saw the sudden appearance of 2,000 suns in the blackness of space. Standing out awesomely in the eternal night of space, their clean rectangular formation put one thought in everyone's mind. God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. Under the light of those 2,000 suns, Jupiter and its moons seemed to have caught fire. The planet's atmosphere, ionized by the radiation, produced lightning that filled the entire fleet-facing hemisphere and covered it in a giant blanket of electric light. The fleet accelerated with no disruption to its formation, its huge wall blocking out the sun, and then made a stately advance into space with the force of a thundercloud, declaring to the universe the dignity and invincibility of the human race. The human spirit that had been repressed since the first appearance of the Trisolaran fleet 2 centuries ago had finally found total liberation. At this moment, all the stars in the galaxy silently held back their light, and human and God stepped out proudly into the universe as one. The people wept and cheered,
and many of them were moved to loud wails. Never before in history had there been such a moment in which every single person felt fortunate and proud to be a member of the human race. But there were some who kept their heads. Luoji was one of them. Surveying the crowd, he noticed that someone else was calm. Shi Qiang was off by himself, leaning against one side of the giant holographic television, smoking a cigarette, and watching the revelers indifferently. Luoji went over and asked, "What are you?"
"Ah, hello, my boy. I've got a duty to fulfill."
He indicated the ebullient crowd.
"Extreme joy easily turns to grief, and now is the best time for something to happen. Like when Mr. Dongguo lectured this morning. If I hadn't come up with the tomatoes and such in a timely fashion, they would have used stones."
Shi Qiang had recently been appointed chief of police for New Life Village No. 5. To the hibernators, the fact that someone belonging to the Asian fleet, someone who no longer was a Chinese citizen, had been given an official post in the national government was a little strange. However, his work had been universally acclaimed among the villagers.
"Besides, I'm not the type to get carried away," he continued, clapping Luoji across the shoulders. "Neither are you, my boy."
"No, I'm not," Luoji nodded. "I was always out for instant gratification. The future had nothing to do with me, even though for a while there, I was forced to become a messiah. Maybe my present state is a sort of compensation for the harm from that. I'm going to bed. Believe it or not, Da Shi, I'll actually be able to get to sleep tonight."
"Go and see your colleague. He just arrived. Humanity's victory might not be a good thing for him."
Luoji was slightly taken aback by this remark. Looking at the man Shi Qiang pointed to, he realized with surprise that it was the old wall-facer Bill Hines. His face was ashen, and he seemed to be in a trance. He had been standing not far off from Shi Qiang, and had only just now noticed Luoji. When they hugged each other in greeting, Luoji felt that Hines's body seemed to tremble with weakness.
"I came looking for you," he said to Luoji. "Only the two of us, history's rubbish, understand each other. But now, I'm afraid even you don't understand me."
"What about Keiko Yamasuki?"
"Remember the meditation room in the UN Assembly Building?" Hines said. "It was always deserted. Tourists only visited occasionally. Do you remember the chunk of iron ore? She committed seppuku on top of it."
"Oh."
"Before she died, she cursed me, saying that my life would be worse than death, since I'm marked with the mental seal of defeatism, even as humanity is victorious. She was right. I'm in real pain right now. Of course, I'm happy for the victory, but it's impossible for me to believe any of it. It's like there are two gladiators fighting in my mind. You know, it's far harder than trying to believe that water is drinkable."
After he and Shi Qiang had gotten Hines set up with a room, Luoji returned to his own room and soon fell asleep. Once again, he dreamed of Zhuang Yan and the child. When he woke, the sun was shining through the window, and the revelries were still going on outside. Natural selection flew at 1% of the speed of light on a course between Jupiter and the orbit of Saturn. Behind it, the sun was now small, although it was still the brightest of the stars, while up ahead, the Milky Way shone with an even greater brilliance. The ship's heading was more or less in the direction of Cygnus, but in the expanse of outer space, its speed was imperceptible. To a nearby observer, natural selection would have seemed suspended in deep space. From its own vantage point, in fact, all movement throughout the universe had been erased, leaving the ship seemingly in a static state, with the Milky Way ahead and the sun behind. Time seemed to have stopped.
"You have failed,"
Dongfang Yanxu said to Zhang Beihai. All personnel aboard the ship but the two of them were still in deep-sea sleep state. Zhang Beihai remained shut inside the spherical compartment, and Dongfan Yanxu, unable to enter, had to talk with him through the communication system. Through the section of bulkhead that was still transparent, she could see the man who had hijacked humanity's most powerful warship floating quietly in the center of the compartment, head bent, intent on writing in a notebook. In front of him floated an interface that showed the ship on standby for ahead four, ready to go at the press of a button. Around him floated several globs of liquid deep-sea acceleration fluid that hadn't yet been evacuated. His uniform had dried, but its wrinkles made him look much older. He ignored her and continued to write, head bent.
The pursuing force is only 1.2 million kilometers away from natural selection, she said.
I know, he said without looking up. You were wise to keep the entire ship in deep sea state.
It had to be this way. Otherwise, agitated officers and soldiers would have attacked this cabin, and if you took natural selection to ahead four at will, you would have killed them all. That's also the reason why the pursuers haven't closed in.
He said nothing. Flipping a page in the notebook, he continued writing.
You wouldn't do that, would you?
She asked softly.
You never imagined I'd do what I'm doing now.
He paused a few seconds, then added,
The people of my time have our own ways of thinking.
But we're not enemies.
There are no permanent enemies or comrades. Only permanent duty.
Then your pessimism about the war is totally unfounded. Tri-Solaris has just shown signs of wanting talks, and the combined solar fleet has set off to intercept the Tri-Solaran probe. The war will end with a victory for humanity.
I've seen the news that came in.
And you still persist in your defeatism and escapism?
I do.
She shook her head in frustration.
Your way of thinking really is different from ours. For instance, you knew from the start that your plan would be unsuccessful, because natural selection has only a fifth of its fuel and is certain to be caught.
He set down his pencil and looked out of the cabin at her. His eyes were calm as water.
We're all soldiers. But do you know what the biggest difference between soldiers from my time and soldiers now is? You determine your actions according to possible outcomes. But for us, we must carry out our duty, regardless of the outcome. This was my only chance, so I took it.
You're saying that to comfort yourself.
No, it's my nature. I don't expect you to understand, Dongfang. We're separated by 2 centuries, after all.
So you've carried out your duty, but there's no hope for your escapist endeavor. Surrender.
He smiled at her, then looked back at his writing.
It's not time yet. I need to write down all that I've experienced. Everything across 2 centuries needs to be written down, so that it might be of assistance to a few sober-minded people in the next 2 centuries.
You can dictate to the computer.
No. I'm used to writing by hand. Paper lasts longer than a computer. Don't worry. I'll bear full responsibility.
Ding Yi looked out through Quantum's broad portal. Even though the holographic display in the spherical cabin provided a better view, he still liked seeing things with his own eyes. What he saw was that he was situated on a large plane consisting of 2,000 small, dazzling suns whose light seemed to set his gray hair aflame. The sight had grown familiar to him in the days since the launch of the combined fleet, but its grandeur still shook him each time he looked. The fleet was not just in this configuration as a show of force or majesty. In a traditional naval configuration of staggered columns, the radiation produced by the engine of every warship would have an effect on the ships to the rear. In this rectangular formation, the ships were separated by about 20 kilometers. Even though each of them was an average of 3 to 4 times the size of a naval aircraft carrier, from that distance, they were practically dots, with only the glow of the fusion engines to prove their existence in space. The combined fleet was in a dense formation, one that had only ever been used in fleet review. In a normal cruising formation, the ships ought to have been spaced at roughly 300 to 500 kilometers, so a 20-kilometer spacing was basically like sailing hull to hull through the ocean. Many of the generals in the three fleets disagreed with this dense formation, but conventional formations presented a number of thorny problems. First of all, there was the principle of fairness in battle opportunity. If the probe were approached in a standard formation, then the ships at the edge would still be tens of thousands of kilometers away from the target when the formation reached minimum distance. If combat broke out during the capture, a fair number of the ships could not have been considered to have taken part, leaving them nothing in the history books but eternal regret. But the three fleets couldn't break off into their own sub-formations, because it was impossible to coordinate which of them would occupy the most advantageous position in the overall formation. So the formation had to be made as dense as possible, a review formation that placed all ships within combat distance of the probe. A second reason for selecting this formation was that the Fleet International and the United Nations both desired stunning visuals, not so much to show off for Tri-Solaris, as to give the masses something to look at. The visual impact held enormous political significance for both groups. With the main enemy force still 2 light-years away, the dense formation was certainly not in danger. Quantum was located in a corner of the formation, giving Ding Yi a view of the majority of the fleet. When they crossed the orbit of Saturn, all the fusion engines turned toward the forward direction, and the fleet began to decelerate. Now, as the fleet closed in on the Tri-Solaran probe, its velocity was negative. It was traveling back toward the sun as it closed the distance separating it from its target. Ding Yi put a pipe to his lips. With no loose tobacco in this age, it was an empty pipe that dangled there, the lingering flavor of 2-century-old tobacco, faint and indistinct, like a memory of the past. He had been reawakened 7 years earlier and had been teaching in the Peking University Physics Department since then. Last year, he had put in a request to the fleet, asking to be one of the people who would examine the Tri-Solaran probe up close when it was intercepted. Although Ding Yi was held in high regard, his request had been refused until he declared that he would kill himself in front of the three fleet commanders if they did not comply. Then they said they would think about it. In fact, selection of the first person to contact the probe was a knotty problem, because first contact with the probe meant first contact with Tri-Solaris. According to the fairness principle to be observed during interception, none of the three fleets could be permitted to enjoy this honor alone. But sending someone from each of them presented operational problems and could complicate matters. So the mission had to be undertaken by someone outside Fleet International. Ding Yi was naturally the most suitable candidate, although another unstated reason lay at the core of his request's ultimate approval. Neither the Fleet International nor the Earth International had much confidence in obtaining the probe, because it was practically certain to self-destruct during or after intercept. Before it did so, close-range observation and contact were imperative if they wanted to obtain as much data as possible. As the discoverer of the macro atom and the inventor of controlled fusion, the veteran physicist was completely qualified in this area. At any rate, Ding Yi's life was his own, and at 83, his unparalleled qualifications naturally gave the old man the power to do anything he wanted. At the final meeting of Quantum Command before the intercept began, Ding Yi saw an image of the Tri-Solaran probe. 3 tracking craft had been dispatched by the three fleets to replace Earth International's Blue Shadow. They had captured an image at a distance of 500 kilometers from the target. the closest that any human spacecraft had come to the probe. The probe was about as large as expected, 3.5 meters long, and when Ding Yi saw it, he had the same impression as everyone else, a droplet of mercury. The probe was a perfect teardrop shape, round at the head and pointy at the tail, with a surface so smooth it was a total reflector. The Milky Way was reflected on its surface as a smooth pattern of light that gave the mercury droplet a pure beauty. Its droplet shape was so natural that observers imagined it in a liquid state,